Let me begin this morning by reminding you about our lesson that we shared last week, was building a bridge to the harvest. And in that lesson, I shared with you some words that Jesus said. And over in John, the fourth chapter, he says, "Do not say that there are yet 4 months and then comes the harvest. Lift up your eyes and look, the fields are already white to harvest." And then earlier in Matthew, the ninth chapter, around verse 36 and 37, Jesus said, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Pray to the Lord of harvest to send out harvesters into the harvest." And so I talked to you about the fact that the harvest really is plentiful. It was plentiful in Jesus' day. It certainly is even more so plentiful today when you think about just the world's population itself. And so I said to you that, Jesus was saying that the problem when it comes to the harvest is not the harvest itself. It is plentiful. The problem is with harvesters. And so you were challenged and encouraged to harvest, to go out and start reaping the harvest. And that should be an individual responsibility that each of us takes up on ourselves. But sometimes we might wonder in our minds, well, how exactly am I to go about doing that? How can I be one who reaches out into the harvest? Well, the good news is this, is that on September the 15th, there is a National Back to Church Sunday. So it's about a month and a half away, or maybe, well, yeah, thereabouts. And you know, that's going to be a time when we're going to be encouraged to be attenders of the church. Maybe it's the local body, or maybe it's a friend that you might invite to come to the church. We're going to use it in conjunction with our Friends Day, which is on September the 15th as well. And so I got to thinking about our congregation, and you may or you may not know this, but our congregation, in terms of numbers, there are like 470-plus individuals that are a part of this congregation. I'm talking about men, women, and children. And what I would like to encourage you to do over the next month and a half is to start encouraging all of our members that on Sunday, September the 15th, that they're all going to be here. It'd be incredible for us to see that kind of number. Now, obviously, there are those who are shut-ins in our congregation and simply cannot make it here, but the vast majority can. And so let me encourage you to set apart that day, or aside that particular day, September the 15th, for National Back to Church Sunday, and that you be here. But not only that, but that you invite a friend or a neighbor. We're also going to use that in conjunction with an evangelistic effort where we're going to go out into our community, and we've identified about 20 people or so within our congregation that we would call frontline kind of individuals who are going to lead us in knocking doors and going up to people's houses and simply remind them of National Back to Church Sunday and invite them to come and worship with us on that particular Sunday. We're also going to do a short three-sentence survey of our community. And so some of you might say, well, you know what? I'm just not one who's able to talk at the door. You don't have to talk at the door. You can be the support of the one who is going to be speaking at the door, and you can keep record of the survey that we're going to be doing. I'll say more about that in weeks to come and so forth. But just remember, September the 15th, start reminding other church members and members of this congregation about that day, and let's pack our building on that particular day on this National Back to Church Sunday. Let's begin with a word of prayer before I get into our lesson, okay? Our Father in heaven, indeed you are such a great God. Father, you deserve so much, and we depend on you so much. This morning, Father, my prayer on my part is that I ask that you would be with me as I share this lesson, that I'd be able to articulate your truths in plain ways and in relevant ways that these people who are listening under the sound of my voice might be able to hear with their ears. Not just sounds, Father, but that they would listen to the words and the implication of those words to their lives. I pray, Father, that you will be with their minds, that they might be able to comprehend the truths, and that they might allow those truths to move from their heads, Father, down to their hearts. And so I ask that you'd be with their hearts and that you'd make them soft, Father, and that they'd be good soil to listen to your word. I pray your blessings in all of this, Father, both for they as well as myself. I ask this in your son's name. Amen. In the spring of 1969, Paul Simon, who was a part of the singing duo Simon and Garfunkel, was feeling really down. He was feeling weary about the world in which he lived. He found himself sometimes breaking down into tears. He felt so small when he looked at the world around. And the reason why he's feeling that way is because a lot was happening. Bobby or Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King were no longer among us, men who were world shakers in many ways. They had been assassinated. There seemed to be a lot of racial disruption across the nation. Riots were happening. The Vietnam War was not a popular war. It was becoming even more unpopular as streets were being filled with protests, as well as college campuses. Protests were going on there. And so Paul Simon was feeling extremely down. And so on one particular day, he walked into his apartment that looked over the East River. And as he looked over across the East River, he thought about some words. And so he decided to pin down some words for solace for himself. And the words that were on his mind for over a week were these words here: when you're weary, when you're feeling small, when tears are in your eyes, I will dry them all. Now, Art Garfunkel was the one who would sing those lyrics there. And if you don't know what they are because of just the age thing there, when you're weary, feeling small, when tears are in your eyes, I will dry them all. And then he went on and he wrote some more lyrics to it, but he ran into a roadblock. He didn't know, how do I finish this song? And he said, I just didn't know what to do. But he was able to accomplish it because from time to time over the next month, he'd walk into his small apartment and he would put on a record, a gospel record, a Southern gospel record that was written by a group by the name of Swan Silverstones. And in their album that they had written, there was one part in one of the songs that a lead singer would say, he'd say, like a bridge over deep waters, if you trust in my name, I will be there. And he said, you know what? He goes, I thought, that's it. That's the thing that's really going to make this song speak to the nation. So he says, so I stole those words from them, and I changed them up a little bit, and they came like this. Like a bridge over troubled waters, I will lay me down. And then later on in the song, like a bridge over troubled waters, I will heal your mind, or I will ease your mind. They became great words, and they became a song that became just a huge hit. And Simon said that he couldn't wait to go and tell Garfunkel about what he had found and the song that he had written. And he said to him, he said, you know what? He goes, this song is not for my voice, but it really is for your voice. You have that tenor. You have this great voice that will really make this song really ring clear and will really bring a message to the people who are around us and so forth. And Garfunkel, he is more than happy to do it. And so On January, I think, 1970, they introduced the song to the world and so forth. And it was a huge hit. It became number one. It spent 6 weeks as number one on the charts. In the UK, it was like 3 weeks. It swept the Grammys in 1971, claiming 6 awards, including Song of the Year and Album of the Year. Like a Bridge Over Troubled Waters really resonated with that generation of people. And I would say to you today that if that song had been written or was written even today, it would be a number one hit and would fly off the charts just as Simon and Garfunkel's song did, like a bridge over troubled waters. And what happened was the song itself, A Bridge Over Troubled Water, it became kind of a metaphor for the crushing blows of life. As you live life, you're going to find yourself from time to time where just the blows of life come crushing down upon you, and you will find yourself in the midst of troubled waters. In fact, when we move in our lives, as we move from point A to point B in life, we're going to find ourselves from time to time in these troubled waters, and it doesn't matter who you are. You can be young, you can be old, you can be rich, you can be poor, you can be educated, not educated. You can be a non-believer. You can be the most devout and faithful Christian on the face of the planet, and you can find yourself in the midst of troubled waters. And when you find yourself in the midst of troubled waters, you're going to find yourself asking lots of questions. You're going to find yourself quizzing yourself, saying to yourself, why in the world does God allow me to go through these troubled waters? Why has He allowed my loved ones to go through troubled waters? And the Bible, unsurprisingly, tells us a number of the reasons why we sometimes find ourselves in the midst of troubled waters. Some of that I just quickly identified. There may be more than these, but one is that, you know, we just live in a sinful world. We live in an evil world. In our world today, our world, in my estimation, and it might be just because of my age and so forth, but in our world today, it seems that we are moving further and further away from God. And as we jettison God out of society as a moral compass and one who sets boundaries and standards for our lives, we become less godly. As we become less godly, we become more evil, and evil things begin to happen in our world. As we have watched, as Dave mentioned to us about shootings across America, why do people do those kinds of things? I can tell you there's a void inside their souls that only God can fill up. We live in a sinful world, and because of that, people find themselves in troubled waters, not of their own making, but sometimes by the making of others. Suffering in troubled waters sometimes are the consequences of our sins, our own choices that we make. Sometimes we make choices in life that are contrary to God's will, and when we do that, life is going to go bump for us. We're going to find ourselves in troubled waters. Sometimes troubled waters happen to test our character, to find out what we are made of. If we didn't know where our faith was, if we were not able to gauge our faith, then sometimes when we find ourselves in the midst of a trial or a test, we find out what kind of people we are, how deep we are, how much we have faith in God, and how much we do trust in God. And then sometimes God is just showcasing us to Satan. Satan is saying that you people out there, you would never trust God unless God has a hedge built around you and takes care of your every need and gives you everything you want. Without that, you would not trust God. And if you were to suffer physically or health-wise and so forth, you wouldn't trust God either. You would put your faith in God. You would turn away from God, and you might even curse God if that were to happen. And so sometimes God may allow us to go through things, not cause us to go through things, but allow us to go through things just to show God, or so Satan, that listen, my people are my people, and they'll love me because they know there's more to life than just what happens on the earth. There's life beyond this, and they put their faith and their hope and their trust in me because of that. A perfect example of a man who found himself in troubled waters is Job. If you open your Bibles to Job chapter 1, in Job chapter 1, there we see a scene here. In the very first verse, it says there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright and fearing God and turning away from evil. You know who Satan hates more than anything in the world is a man who is blameless and upright and turns away from every evil. God loves that kind of person, but Satan hates them with a serious degree of hate. As you go on down through there, God allows several things to happen to Job. Remember, he's a blameless man. He's a man with integrity. And as he goes through life, things start to go bump for him very quickly. Beginning in verse 13, going down through 19, we learn that Job's family had come together. His sons were together, and they were in a feast, and they're drinking wine and so forth. And it says that the Sabaeans came in, and they attacked their herds. They were oxen and so forth. And it says, and they stole them away and killed all the servants, and one was left to come and tell Job what had happened. And then it says that, you know, a fire came down, and it fell upon the sheep, and the sheep were killed along with the servants, and one survived and came and told Job what happened with that as well. And then it said the Chaldeans in groups, they came in raids, and they raided the other herds of Job, his camels and so forth, and killed all of his servants, and one survived and came and told Job what had happened. Pretty bad day for Job, wouldn't you say? I mean, he has lost all of his wealth. He's left all his means. He's lost a tremendous amount of things. He's lost servants who were some probably were his friends and so forth. He's lost all of that. And then it says that there came a great wind, and this great wind blew against the house in which his children were having this feast, and all of them were killed. Now he's lost all his children. It's one thing to lose a child, and I would not ever minimize that. It must be terrible to lose a child, to lose all your children in one fell stroke like that. Had to be absolutely devastating. Everything that was valuable to Job in terms of health, in terms of wealth, in terms of intimate, close relationships, he lost. And then to build on top of that, verses 7 to 9 in the 7th chapter, it says that Job was attacked with an illness that was so severe that he had boils from the soles of his feet to the top of his head. I don't know if you've ever had a boil, but those things are incredibly painful. If you've had a pimple, you got an idea of it. But all you got to do is maximize that on steroid, and you know it's painful from the soles of your feet to the top of your head. In fact, it says that Job is so messed up physically that he finds himself out on an ash heap, and he is scratching his sores with broken pottery. This man's life was in shambles. He is in troubled waters, up to his neck, if not over his head. And then his wife comes to Job, and he says to him, "Why do you hold to your integrity in such a way? Why don't you curse God and die?" And Job says, "You are a foolish woman. Should we accept prosperity from God and good that he gives us and not accept adversity?" And it says that he held to his integrity, that he refused to sin with his lips. That is, he would not curse God, and he worshiped. He bowed down, and he worshiped the God of heaven, a man on an ash heap, a man in troubled waters, and yet he was still able to look above, treading there, and look to God in a moment of trouble. Troubled waters. Sometimes we find ourselves in that situation. Listen, the Bible talks about people in troubled waters. Jesus said that in this world, you'll find yourselves in the midst of troubled waters from time to time. Over in John, he said these words, "These things I have written or spoken to you, that in me you might find peace," or have peace. "In this world, you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world." It seems to be almost a direct opposite. In this world, you have tribulation, but be of good cheer. That sounds kind of weird to me, and yet that's what he says. The point that I'm saying to you is that Jesus said, as long as you live from point A to point B, you're going to have tribulation. You're going to have troubled waters. And his brother James would later say over in James, the first chapter, verses 2 and 3, he would say, "Count it all joy, my brother, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. Let endurance have its perfect result, that you may be perfected and that you'd be lacking in nothing." Notice what he says, "Count it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials." He didn't say if you encounter various trials. He says when you encounter various trials, which means encountered trials are coming and that the troubled waters are on the way. Life is full of troubled waters. But I don't want to talk to you about the reasons for why troubled waters come. If you're in the midst of troubled water, you know exactly what I'm talking about. If you've been in troubled water, you know that it probably fits in one of those four categories that I shared with you just a few moments ago. What I want to talk to you about is about building a bridge over troubled waters. How do we go about building a bridge that goes over troubled waters when you're weary, when you're feeling small, when tears fill your eyes? How do you get it so that they're dry again? Where are you to go when you find yourself in the midst of troubled waters? Well, one of the things that happens to us, I think, that is probably natural to human beings is that when we find ourselves in troubled waters, we begin to think to ourselves, God must have abandoned me. I feel alone. I'm by myself in this water here. Where has God gone? And I just want you to know, and I want you to remember and bring to your remembrance is that God never leaves us. He's promised to never leave us. God has said, "Never will I leave you, never will I forsake you." So we may say with confidence, "The Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid." When you're in troubled waters, it's hard not to be afraid. When you're in troubled waters, it's hard not to feel isolated, to feel lonely, to maybe even be angry about those things when you find yourself intimate. But I want you to know that even in the midst of troubled water, while you are treading in that water, God promises never to abandon us. But here's what happens. When we're in the midst of troubled waters, a number of things happen because of who we are. Sometimes what happens is when we find ourselves in troubled water is the panic mode kicks in. We become panicking. Something's got to happen here. I don't like being in this water. And so we try to swim our way out of the troubled water. We try to fix it if we can. As men, we try to fix things and so forth. But we try to fix things. And so we try to swim our way out of the troubled water under our own power. So we rely upon our own powers, only to find out that we really are powerless to swim out of the water. We really don't have it in us to swim out. Sometimes physically, sometimes emotionally, sometimes spiritually. It's just not in us to do so. And eventually, if we're followers of God, we realize that we can't get out. And when we can't get out, we realize that there's only one way, one thing to do, and that is to look up. And so finally, we allow God to help us. we allow him just to, you know, come into our lives and to help us out in that thing. But here's the problem with that. You give that to God, and God does not always act as fast as we would like him to act. God is going to rescue us, but it may not be on our timing. It may not be the way that we think. In fact, I would say to you that oftentimes God does rescue us, but not in ways that we even imagined he would work in our lives. But all of a sudden he shows up and he works in a wonderful way that helps us out of the water. If not, you may not completely pull us out of the water all at once, but at least you come up for air for a few moments. And God is there as that rescue lifesaver that is there. But while we wait for God's own perfect timing, we continue to suffer. We continue to struggle. I mean, Job's thing wasn't over in a moment. Job prayed and talked to God about what was going on, and he interacted with his friends and argued with his friends and so forth, but he still had to wait on that ash heap before things got better for him. And I'll talk about that more in a moment. Sometimes when that happens, we are tempted to let our focus slip from God and back to our own problems. Yeah, God, here are my problems. Yeah, God, take my problems. But then we find ourselves doing the swimming again. Now we find ourselves trying to take care of things ourselves. And sometimes what happens, if you're like me anyway, is you start feeling sorry for yourself. Why did this happen to me? What did I do to deserve this? How come among all the people on the face of the planet that has to happen to me? The truth of the matter is that most times in any of our troubled water times, it is not unique to us. People all over the planet are going through the same things that we are going through as they struggle in a sinful world, as they struggle with their own choices, as they struggle with trials of character and things of that nature. But nevertheless, we sometimes feel sorry for ourselves and we get really sad and we get really down and we turn really inward. I just want you to know that if you're feeling that way, you're not the Lone Ranger, and people in the past, great spiritual leaders, great men of faith, men like David, who was a man after God's own heart, when he was being chased by Saul, because Saul was wanting to kill him, and David was running for his life, and he's living from cave to cave in a wilderness, he wrote these words: "How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and every day have sorrow in my heart?" Those were the words of a man after God's own heart who felt isolated and abandoned and by himself. And so he's pleading to God, "How long is it going to be like this? Sorrow's filling my day." Or maybe like Job. Job said these words: "Oh, that I knew where I might find him." He's talking about God. "I wish I knew where God was. Oh, that I might find God, that I might come even to his seat. I've got questions. I've got a problem what's going on with me. My friends are telling me that I have sinned, and because of my sin, that's why I'm going through this terrible ordeal. That's why I'm struggling in this troubled waters. And I want to know, why is this happening?" And so he had some questions for God about those things. However, after everything had happened, after he had lost his health, after he had lost his wealth, and worst of all, after he has lost his most precious children, he says these words: "But he knows the way that I take. And when he has tried me, I shall come out as gold." That's what Job's conclusion was. "I don't know where this has all taken me, but I know that he'll be with me all the way. And then when it's all over with, I know that I'll come out good on the other side. I'll come out like gold." And the idea is, it's the idea of metal being inside a furnace, and it's being heated up, and the dross is being, you know, is being melted away, and there's a purifying that takes place there, and something better is on the way. And if you read the very last chapter of Job, you'll find out that he really did come out on the good end. You won't think he does all the way through the vast majority of the chapters, but you get to that last chapter, and you'll find out that he had everything back again in spades. I'm sure he had days when he thought back, but he had those present days and so forth. I'm wondering, when we find ourselves in the middle of our great despair in life, when we are up to our necks in troubled water, do we focus on how God is possibly using our troubles to sharpen us, to strengthen us? Or do we succumb to panic attacks or allow ourselves to be overcome by the water of sorrow and depression and discouragement and anxiety, maybe even anger? Understand, beloved, I'm not disparaging you. I'm not berating you. I'm simply asking you. I'm asking you, when you're in troubled waters, what's on your heart? What's going on when you find yourselves in that? Wouldn't it be better if somehow we were able to understand that God is there at our side and that God is that bridge over troubled waters? That's what He wants to be. When we're weary, when we are feeling small, when tears fill our eyes, isn't God capable of drying them? Isn't He a bridge over troubled waters where He has laid Himself down to help us? And sometimes the way God lays Himself down are ways in which we are surprised about. When I think about that, I think about Luke, the 24th chapter. In Luke, the 24th chapter, Jesus had been crucified. And two disciples are traveling on a road to a village called Emmaus. And as they're traveling along the road, their hearts are broken. They're sorrowful inside. And they're talking about what had gone on in the last days. They're feeling sorrowful. They are grief-stricken. Maybe there's some anger that is there. They're feeling all those feelings. And all of a sudden, a third man enters into the party and begins to walk along with them. And as they walk along with them, this stranger, he's asking them questions. And yet, as they talk to him, there's this comfort that comes inside them because they don't ask him to leave. They don't say, it's none of your business. They want him to stay with them. And later on in the narrative, it says that after they talk about that walk on the road, how he says, did our hearts not burn within us? Did he not give us hope? Did he not give us comfort? And all the way on that road, while they were walking in their grief and in their sorrow and in their troubled waters, Jesus was with them, and they didn't know it. But He was there. And later on, they found that out. And isn't that true? That I believe that even in the midst of the troubled waters that we find ourselves in, we may feel abandoned, we may feel alone, but even in those moments, God is with us. He's walking with us, even in those kinds of moments. I want you to know a mighty truth. And the mighty truth is this. I want you, if you don't take anything else, take this home with you today. God is with you right now. If you're in troubled water, God is with you right now. Cast all your cares on me, he says, for he cares for you. 1 Peter, the second chapter, or fifth chapter, in verse 7. God cares for you. He loves you more than you can possibly imagine. More than you could possibly imagine. Never forget, remember, he is always with you. Here's a second thing. Trust God's timing. When you find yourself in troubled waters, well, what do you want? When it happens and you're in troubled waters, what do you want? Well, I can tell you what I want. I want out of the water. When do I want out of the water? Well, I want it right now. But it doesn't happen that way. You find yourself in the midst of troubled waters, you want out. You want out right now. But sometimes that water is not going to allow you to come out anytime soon. And in those moments, for those of you who went through troubled waters, for those of you who are in the midst of the troubled waters, for those of you who are going to be in troubled waters, you got to remember this: God's timing is perfect and ours is not. What we want instancy. What God wants is eternity. God is more concerned with your eternal welfare than He is probably in the instance of what's going on in your life, because He knows that something happens in the moments of instancy. And as you go from point A to point B, that God can do some incredible, marvelous things. God's timing is perfect. Ours is not. So here's two truths that I've learned as I think about my troubled water times is this. Number one is that sometimes God's waits in order that we might learn some things. And sometimes God often uses people to act as small bridges over troubled water. Let me share with you a personal illustration. As I share this illustration with you, I want you to know that my illustration is not to minimize anything that you're going through, okay? In fact, I would say to you that probably as I share with you one of my troubled water times, that probably mine is nothing more than a cloudburst compared to the torrent that you find yourself in. But the principle is the same. The two principles are the same. The ones that you see behind me always remain. So a little over 3 weeks ago, I found myself in troubled waters. Very sad. Brokenhearted. As you know, my mom passed away about 3.5 weeks ago. Okay, and so she passed away, and at 8:48 in the morning, my brother called me. I was in my truck, sitting on the side of the road, and he says, Jimmy, that's why he calls me, you know, sometimes Richard, but Jimmy, mom has died. I said, okay, I'll be there as soon as I can. So I headed back there, got there Tuesday morning. Tuesday morning, we went to the funeral home, and we made arrangements for my mom's memorial that we decided would happen on Saturday. In between Tuesday and Saturday, a lot of stuff had to happen. My mom was in had an apartment in assisted living, and the assisted living place says, we need that apartment. There's other people who are in need, and so we don't want to push you, but we need you to clear the place out. Well, they didn't quite say it that way, but that's kind of how I took it. You know, and they were nice, you know, they were loving people. So my brother and I, we walked into the place that Tuesday afternoon and looked at the place, and we said, oh, wow. We walked into the place, and I was stunned, not because of what it looked like or anything like that. I was just stunned because I stood there, and I looked, and I thought to myself, how does 90 years of life get condensed into a living room, small bathroom, and a bedroom? How'd that happen? And I looked at her stuff. And her stuff was old furniture, old used furniture. No one wanted it. You know, there's a leather couch that I think was probably 40 years old. Well, no, it was at least 38 years old because she had it when my dad died. So it had to be 38 years old, maybe older than that. She had a comfort chair and an easy chair. She had an old entertainment center, and on the entertainment center she had album picture albums of her family's pictures of her past and whatnot. She had lots of whatnots, doodads, meant nothing to anyone else in there, but she knew a story for every whatnot. She knew the story that went with that whatnot. She knew the memory that it was connected to. So there were all these whatnots, pictures of her family on the wall. Inside her room was a single closet with all of her clothes in there. It was packed with clothes, but I'm telling you, she never wore more than maybe 5% of those clothes in there. She had dementia. She couldn't remember all the beautiful things she had. On her dresser was her jewelry. Wasn't anything expensive, stuff that you could go to a thrift store and buy up in a second, but to her, they were important. At my mom's funeral, all my daughters and my wife, they chose a necklace and wore it. That was way cool. So I looked at those things there, and it had to be cleared out. And so, you know, my wife got the great idea of putting some of it on Facebook and some on Craigslist, and we sold her bedroom set, you know, for a little bit of money that we gave to the home itself, and then a lot of the old stuff, the entertainment center and the chair and that kind of stuff, we took to a thrift store. No one knows the story behind any of that. It's just furniture dropped off there. Went through the week, got it all cleaned up and so forth. And Friday night before my mom's funeral the next day, I was going through pictures, lots of pictures of her family. I never saw all of her family together in one picture before, and there are numerous of them. And they were pictures of my dad's family. I'd never seen all of his brothers, 9 brothers and a sister all together at once. I saw pictures of my granddad that I saw only as an old man laying in a bed dying. And I saw him as a man, you know, with his, and my mom, I said, who's that guy? I said, that's Pony Cisco Sutton. That's my granddad. It was great. Of course, that always makes you feel really melancholy if you've ever done that kind of thing. And out inside the garage, we had placed two small tables. And on the tables, we put my mom's whatnots. And on the other table, we put her jewelry. And when the grandchildren came there, we told them, if you'd like to go pick a memento out from your grandma, then you can go do that. And so the girls and the grandchildren, great-grandchildren, they went through the whatnots, and they each picked out a couple of them. And they went through her jewelry and they took some of her jewelry. I was so glad that they did that. But at the same time, it felt so casual. It was a troubled water time for me. As I thought about what was going on there, on the outside, I had to be strong because I was the oldest son. I was a preacher. And so I had to steel myself and be strong for them. But on the inside, I was crying. I felt like I was drowning in troubled water. You know, I thought about my mom, and I thought, did I tell her I loved her often enough? Was I a good enough son? Could I have done more? And I was flooded with love and dread and regret and anger and then love back around. All those things were flooding into my life. Here's what was interesting, and you can relate to this. You know, while I was going through that, at the beginning of the week, I made a prayer, and in the prayer, I prayed to God, please, God, steal my heart. Thank you, Wendell. Thank you, sister. That's our little bridge right there, by the way. Anyway, okay, I need to get by this and move on to this lesson. So anyway, so I prayed to God, steal my heart, you know, strengthen my heart, help my heart here. I made that prayer, and like all good people do, immediately after I said, God's help my heart here, I decided that I could do it on my own. You know, I can do this on my own. I can be strong on my own, and I started to move forward, you know. And then later I prayed to God, okay, God, why is my heart still sad? Why am I still going through this? What are you doing? And I think what God was saying is God says, you know what, Richard, you just need some time to learn some things. And so when I decided to get out of his way and allow God to work in my life and to move in my life, when I allow that to happen, in God's timing, I learned something. And what I learned was, I learned that there are people that are out there who want to be bridges in your troubled water times. And a friend of mine came to me as a great bridge of troubled water, and he said to me, you know, Richard, he says, you're all worried about your mom's things. See, I was really saddened about her stuff. As a surprise, I was saddened by her earthly stuff. I was saddened by her furniture and by her whatnots that didn't seem to mean as much to them as it did to her. And I was worried that my mom would be hurt about that. And he said to me, you know what, Richard, your mom doesn't care about that stuff. Your mom right now sees the face of Jesus. She's with angels. She's seeing your dad and her mom and her relatives and her friends. And she would rather be there than any place other than having a bunch of whatnots and old furniture. And while I was worried about whatnots and furniture, she was in heaven rejoicing. Isn't that crazy? I'm a preacher. I know that stuff. But I had to learn that from a friend, Charles White. He sent me a text. I got a lot of texts from our elders and from some of you, but Charles White sent me a text. And all it said was this: God's caring for your mother. Charles, that was such a huge bridge. At right the right moment, I needed that bridge. I told Clint I got to go do my mom's funeral, and Clint said to me, Richard, you don't have to do that. Listen, let me do it. I'll drive up to Richland, and I'll do your mom's funeral. You don't have to do that. And I told Clint I had to do this, but Clint, thank you so much. That was such a bridge. It gave me so much strength knowing that if I had to have someone, I knew you'd be there. That's a bridge. And so many of you sent cards and letters and texts. And even up to this morning, people are coming and saying, I'm sorry to hear about your mom's death. Those are small bridges that God builds in our lives that he uses that allows us to cross over troubled waters. Sometimes it's only for a moment. Sometimes it's just for a while. But nevertheless, they're there. And they're things that you're so thankful for when it happens in your life. Don't make the mistake. Don't make God make a mistake that God's patience for his absence. His timing is perfect and his presence is constant. It is always with you. That's biblical, by the way. Faith in God includes faith in his timing. So sometimes you got to wait for God to work in your life. Okay, I don't have time to talk to you about a butterfly. Remain faithful. Remember God is with you. Trust God's timing and remain faithful. Job, that's where he found himself. Job, think about it. He's lost everything. Everything of value he has lost. And when you find yourself in those moments, it's easy to want to question God and to blame God. But Job didn't do that. Job fell down and he worshiped God. I mean, I think he had his moments where he questioned, but he worshiped God. He held on to his faith. We need to hold on to our faith and to trust in God in our troubled water times. God wants to be there for us. Faith is confidence in what we hope for, assurance of what we do not see. We don't see everything that's going on around us, everything that God does, but he does. And we have to have faith that he's going to be there. God cherishes our faith when we're in troubled waters. Without faith, it's impossible to please God, because those who come to God must believe that he is and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Keep your faith, even in the midst of troubled waters. It's so easy for us to give up when we don't see quick results. But we must never give up on God, and our faith must endure the suffering. The church in Thyatira in Revelation 2 and verse 10, Jesus said to them, "Be faithful unto death. I know many of you are persecuted. Some of you will die. Be faithful unto death. I'll give you a crown of life. I'll make it up to you so many times over. Stay faithful. Trust me. Put your hope in me. I am your bridge to eternity." As you go through the troubled waters, three godly principles. One is this: God is our bridge. He is walking beside us, even when we can't see him. He's walking beside us. God's timing is perfect. Even if it seems that it is slow, he is faithfully building a bridge for us over the troubled waters. And then during the worst of storms, God cherishes our faithfulness. He loves us so much when we're like that. Jesus said, "Come to me, ye who are weak and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." That's God's invitation to us. That's Jesus' invitation to you. This morning, I just want you to know that when you're in the midst of troubled waters, God is not on the shore watching you drown. He'll be with you even in the midst of the storm. The other thing is that if you're in the midst of troubled waters right now, okay, it could be that you're a teenager and you're struggling because you're trying to stay faithful in a world that's unfriendly towards Christianity, and you're having to struggle with your faith some. There's a bridge over troubled water. It could be that you have a boss that you have to work for, and makes it really hard to go to work. Maybe that's your troubled water. Maybe your troubled water is that maybe you've made some bad financial moves, and now you find yourself in troubled water. Or maybe a relationship has gone sour, and you're in troubled water. Or maybe you've lost someone, and you're in troubled water. So it's only been like 3.5 weeks, and I still feel like I'm in troubled water. I have moments when I swim out, okay, and bridges are there, but there's sometimes when I'm not, I'm so sorry, Lori, because sometimes I'm short, and sometimes I feel angry, and sometimes I feel alone. And I know all those things are not true, but I still feel those ways. And so this morning I'm forward. I'm forward. I'm going to ask Charles. Charles will be, he's our elder of the month, and he's going to be here with me. And Charles, this morning after I'm done with this lesson, the invitation, I'm going to ask you to pray for me. And I'm going to invite you, my brothers and sisters, if any of you are in troubled water right now, if you're in troubled water right now, I want you to come forward. Come up here and join me. And let's hold hands. And you don't have to say anything. You don't have to say, "Here's what my troubled water." You don't have to tell the story like I did. You're just in troubled water. And if that's who you are, then I want you to come forward. And I just want you to know you're not alone. And so the invitation is yours. And if you find yourself there, once you come, while together we stand and sing and give you opportunity.